Just how mega is the Republican electorate? Do we need to send $40 billion to Ukraine? And who killed the disinformation board? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Madeline Maddie Kearns, and the notorious MBD, Michael Brenda Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Allegiance Gold and Babbel. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. But before we get into it in earnest, let me say a few words about Allegiance Gold, the official gold IRA of The Editors podcast. Inflation rates, of course, are a growing concern for Americans with retirement accounts. Allegiance Gold can help you protect your IRA 401k with physical gold and silver. They'll also give you $500 of free silver. That's $500 of free silver with a qualified purchase. Call 844-790-9191. That's 844-790-9191, or visit allegiancegold.com/editors. That's allegiancegold.com/editors. Please check it out. So MBD, we had some more primaries on Tuesday night. Of course, the overarching theme everyone was looking to was how Trump endorsees were doing. And it was a mixed bag. We still don't know the outcome of Pennsylvania Senate, but Trump endorsed gubernatorial candidate in Pennsylvania wins. But that's clearly just was a bandwagoning Trump endorsement right at the end when this guy Mastorino had already made it obvious he was going to win the Republican nomination by being, you know, just Trumpier than Trump endorsed candidates. Was actually present on January 6th, was a leader in the Stop the Steal movement, and was just stomping the other two plausible candidates in that race. Then you have Dr. Oz, a somewhat unusual endorsement for Trump, but he was sucked in by Trump, Oz's celebrity, a successful TV show, but some damage had already been done to Oz, various socially liberal things he'd said in the past. So the endorsement was not transformative. That race is basically a tie. I think I was just looking a second ago, Oz is maybe ahead by less than 1,000 votes now. And the thinking seems to be that the more establishment candidate McCormick may overtake him with the mail-in vote. Then you have Madison Cawthorn down in North Carolina, very Trumpy candidate, but one that had embarrassed himself and his district and the institution of Congress over and over again, getting nipped in that race by a really solid guy, Chuck Edwards. What's your big takeaway?
My big takeaway is that Yuval Levin is always right. People may recall that listeners may recall that Yuval Levin wrote a piece for us about Trump's counterproductive strategy of endorsements. You know, Trump doesn't have to endorse anyone, right? He's the last president of the party. And by endorsing so promiscuously in these primary contests, he is habituating voters to separating themselves from him in some way, and even habituating some elected officials to seeing their fortunes as not necessarily tied to Donald Trump.
Because the endorsements are random and may actually go against kind of grassroots mega sentiment.
Both that and sometimes, you know, his the people he endorses lose. You know, so the endorsing by Trump is keeping Trump in the headlines, and yeah, it has maybe some disciplining effect on some of the primary fields, but it's dangerous. And like in Pennsylvania, I mean, I know a lot of voters who loved Lou Barletta, right? Who was a mayor of Allentown. I think I profiled him in like 2006 or seven. This guy was a Trump Republican, you know, a decade before Trump was. He was a guy who was tough on illegal immigration, you know, a kind of culture warrior on guns and other issues. and a very credible person and candidate as far as elected officials. And he was the first guy in Pennsylvania to vote for or to endorse Trump in 2015, which was at the time pretty costly to do in the Republican Party. And, you know, he's left now saying, like, where's the loyalty? Where was the loyalty?
That's the most hilarious thing that happened last week.
Which is funny because, of course, Trump isn't loyal to his wives or anyone else.
There's another congressman there in Pennsylvania who also was an early endorsee who gave this 1 minute excoriating, heartbroken speech about where the loyalty is from Trump. Like, he hadn't paid any attention the last 5 years.
Right. But I mean, there are people who are, there are Republicans who are committed to some of these ideas that believe that the ideas deserve support more than celebrity. So it was a mixed bag. I mean, I think Pennsylvania is a disaster now for Republicans. I think it's a disaster in that this is a winnable state. In this era, and it's a very favorable year for Republicans, and they looks like they are set on candidates who could blow it. As for Cawthorn, though, I mean, that's a net win, right? That's, you know, we are seeing, I think voters really do want politicians to not embarrass them. I think that's one of the reasons Trump lost his second term, is because he had such a propensity for embarrassing his own supporters with his antics, with his tweets, whatever. And Cawthorn was nothing but the tweets, nothing but the embarrassments. So it's good to get that out. And it's good for Republican voters to clarify that it's not just a game. It's not just about entertaining them from the hustings or owning the libs, that the politics of politics actually matters. So anyway, it was a mixed bag of a night, but I'm sad to see Pennsylvania being just tossed away.
Yeah, so Matt, you have to say I have a very pessimistic take on all this as someone that welcome some version of Trumpism or be okay with it without Trump. I just don't think that's where we're headed. I think you look at the endorsements as a sheer formal matter and conclude, you know, in the right circumstance, Trump's endorsement's worth 10, maybe 20 points. You know, J.D. Vance, pretty good candidate, better than the guys who are ahead of him. Trump can make a difference, but Trump can't make something happen out of nowhere or, hide someone's obvious vulnerabilities the way he as we saw, seeing with Oz and saw with Cawthorn, and can't, you know, topple a popular incumbent Republican governor or Republican primary, as we saw out in Idaho with Brad Little beating back easily the Trump-backed challenger, as we'll see next week with Brian Kemp, who's going to totally paste Dave Perdue, who's just a Trump vendetta candidate. But broad gauge, this is a Trump party. The non-Trump vote, as we saw in Ohio with Dolan's, about 25%. You saw non-Trump backed candidates in some cases beating making a serious challenge to the Trump backed candidates by being Trumpier than the Trump backed candidates. Mastorino, that wasn't a Trump phenomenon. That was a grassroots spontaneous phenomenon that Trump got on board. McCormick was running sort of in the Trump lane against Oz, and this woman, Kathy Barnett, came out of nowhere to get 25% of the vote, more MAGA, more Trumpy than the Trump-endorsed candidate Oz, and that's about 75% of the Pennsylvania Senate primary electorate. So that's just Trump's imprint on this party is enormous. Some of the endorsements are stupid. Some of them are counterproductive for his purposes. Some are bad for the party. But I think that's not the big story. The big story, it's a MAGA party, it's a Trump party, and that pretty much the price of entry, with a few exceptions, is buying into that stuff at a certain level.
Yeah, I would pick up on something Michael said as well, which is that the risk with Trump endorsing people is that these candidates lose. And you can tell that this is something he's worried about, It was interesting to see that on his other version, alternative version of Twitter, Truth Social, he had said if Dr. Oz should just basically declare victory, don't bother waiting for the count, because it makes them harder to cheat. So if it ends up being that David McCormick wins, he's now playing the voter fraud card again. And of course, he's attacking a fellow Republican in this instance. And we saw the damage that did in the 2021 Georgia Senate runoff. So definitely this is a risk for Trump personally, but also potentially causes problems for the GOP more generally. And to your point about the Trump MAGA movement, I think I was really convinced by Peggy Noonan's recent column on this, basically suggesting that Trump is following his base. His base aren't following him at this point. So he's almost trying to calculate where they're going to be supportive and then endorsing those candidates. And actually, as much as the MAGA movement has a lot of appetite for chaos and disruption, it's really, I think, mostly where that can be politically effective. And the question now is whether Trump is actually an effective representative of that cause, whether we want they want someone a bit more like Ron DeSantis, who is disruptive enough, who is against the establishment, but actually capable of getting things done. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Yeah, so Charlie, there are all sorts of recriminations over the nomination of Mastorino, who the Democrats clearly wanted. I don't totally discount the possibility that in this year in particular, Mastorino might possibly win, but obviously a very long shot, and just a bizarre spectacle of a party in a major state, a winnable state, just saying, screw it, we're driving off a cliff. You know, we don't care. And, you know, these recriminations based on, well, you know, why didn't this billionaire who's backing Bill McSwain, who finished third, why didn't he get off sooner and go to the guy who's second? You know, all that is details compared to the fact that this is what the Republican electorate wanted.
Yeah, we have seen this before. There's no guarantee that when presented with the prospect of a wave, Republican primary voters will pick candidates who are capable of surfing that wave. Sometimes they will pick candidates who are destined to drown in it. This looks like the same mistake in Pennsylvania, but yeah, Politico writing it up said Biden's approval rating keeps going down, inflation stays with us, economy remains a source of concern, gas prices keep rising. Maybe this guy becomes the governor. Now, you might think if you like Mastriano, then you win. I'm not sure looking at him, he is destined, if he does become governor, to be an especially effective one. So I think in both cases, Republicans have limited their chances. They've limited their chances of winning the governor's race in Pennsylvania and by extension winning the Senate race, because they will bleed into each other. And they've limited their chance of electing a Republican to the governor's mansion in Pennsylvania, who would be an effective governor, who would have a chance at re-election, who would appeal to broad coalitions within the state, and who could advance conservative policies. Now, you can overstate that. One of the most common headlines that I see is that the Pennsylvania legislature has passed a bill and that Governor Wolf, Democrat, has vetoed it. This is especially true when it comes to gun policy, for example. But you know, Republicans need to recognize that a lot of politics is iterative. It's not just about winning the race or choosing a candidate who can win, although it's obviously important. It's about building majorities and building policy wins. And clearly, Doug Mastriano is not that guy. So I found this frustrating. I don't tend to worry too much about governor's races in states I don't live in. They don't affect me really at all. I worry about Senate races because the federal government is unfortunately all powerful, and As a result, what the people of Pennsylvania choose to do in their Senate race does affect me. One thing I thought was appalling, and this in no way lets Republican primary voters off the hook. They were the ones who chose Mastriano, and they must deal with that. But one thing I did think was appalling was that Shapiro, the Democratic candidate for governor in Pennsylvania, helped Mastriano get there because he thought he'd be easy to beat. Now, that's fine. That's politics. That's happened. It's time immemorial. But you cannot do that and then decry the person that you helped manipulate into the position a danger, a threat. You can't play the country over party card if you have been involved in putting them in a position in which they could win because you thought they'd be easier to beat. You have to pick one. If you think they're general Republican or do Republican things, whatever, and they'd be easier to beat, good luck to you. But we've seen this quite a lot in the last few years, and I've just grown tired of it. We saw it famously with Trump in 2016.
So Charlie, I'm going to stick with you for a second. So what's your level of concern, you know, when it comes to the other side saying, oh my gosh, Republicans are going to steal the election in 2024. Most of that I completely discount. There are all sorts of checks and balances in the system. There's not one person who can press the button, as we discussed a lot in 2020. But what's your level of concern with Mastriano? Trump is the nominee again, close race in Pennsylvania that he loses to the Democrat. What would be your level of concern that Mastriano doesn't accept it and does something to try to change the outcome and defy the will of Pennsylvania voters?
Well, I would be concerned that he might try. I wouldn't be concerned that he would succeed. The attempt would, of course, be a problem in its own right. We shouldn't discount that. But we should also remember that the Constitution countenances and expects politicians to behave badly. It expects prosecutors to behave badly. The test of it is not whether it prophylactically prevents that from happening, but what it does about it once it has. You know, we don't have a provision in the Constitution that prevents a prosecutor from bringing a murder trial against somebody out of spite. We do have provisions in the Constitution that limit what happens after that occurrence. So you can't stop Mastriano from playing games here. Republican primary voters should have done that job. But if he were to win the race, you can't stop him holding a press conference, using executive orders, trying to work with the legislature. But ultimately, that isn't how the American system of government works. So if Mastriano were that guy and he were to take that course, then it would be damaging because he would further damage our trust in elections in exactly the same way as Stacey Abrams did over and over and over and over again and was perversely celebrated for it. But as in the Abrams case, he wouldn't prevail. So it worries me culturally. It doesn't worry me structurally.
So MBD, let's talk some more, as we have in the past, about the irony of your position. You know, it's a little bit like, I don't know, West Coast rap or something that was, but you're fringy and outrageous, you know, 20 years ago. And now the Super Bowl halftime show, you're doing it and you're the moderate. You're kind of dead center within the conservative movement and the Republican Party now. But discuss the fact that we have this populist uprising, which has some kind of ideological and policy charge, which I think would be, you know, what you've wanted for you know, a while, yeah, and big tech, et cetera. But then the real emotive power of it, the real center of gravity of it, though, is the 2020 election was stolen, and we have a blind loyalty to Donald Trump. You know, places where you you know, have been things you've been warning against.
Yeah, well, one thing I've kind of accepted, and it's something I think every stripe of conservative should learn to appreciate, is that there's a difference between, you know, what we're doing at National Review and kind of our audience, and then the audience that politicians have in an election. And, you know, there were a lot of people, I think, who even just 12 years ago during like kind of the Tea Party era of the Republican Party, you know, thought like, oh, great, this is like, wow, I'm seeing a revival of Hayekianism here. And then they like actually go to the Tea Party conference with the guys in the tri-corner hats, and they're just talking about, I don't know, Trayvon Martin or something, you know. So there's just going to be a gap between someone like me and then, you know, Joe the Plumber. So I accept that. But that's why we have Republican institutions. Like the genius of our Constitution, right, is that our institutions are supposed to elicit, filter out the crassness from the masses, and at the same time supposed to limit the self-interest and self-seeking of elites. And so, like, as I'm seeing, yeah, a couple of my political positions are becoming more popular in the Republican Party, but there's still this common need to repair our institutions to make sense of those political intuitions in the public and translate them into a real governing agenda. But yeah, it's, of course, it's a mixed feeling, right? I mean, I think even when I came to National Review, it wasn't long afterward, I wrote about the, like, the queasiness everyone should feel when someone of their sect of conservatism arises to become president, because it's just
it's like a guarantee that you're going to be
discredited by, because events and character move things. And of course, there is no, you know, there's this kind of foolish utopianism that stalks American politics, like, well, if we did all of my ideas, it would all work out. But in fact, sometimes a lot of politics is steering in the right direction, but you can easily go off course if you oversteer. So, you know, it's an interesting time. I mean, I'm excited that there are races. So, for instance, the race Rand Paul is facing this year, right? Rand Paul is, you know, effectively the anti-war candidate, and the far left progressive running against him, who's a no-hoper, is pro-war, right? Is for getting even more involved in Ukraine. So yeah, that's like a race I'm very interested in, and it's a race that wouldn't have existed a decade ago, not in that configuration.
So Charlie Cook, next question to you. As a non-Trump Republican who doesn't want Trump to win the Republican nomination in 2024, the lesson from the primary season so far is that we are mildly effed, moderately effed, hugely effed, cosmically effed, not effed at all.
Moderately effed. So left in moderation is a conservative response.
So judicious. Maddie Kearns.
I agree. I think judicious. Moderately.
Moderate. All right, MBD. We got two moderates.
I think I would go a little bit stronger than that. What's the
hugely?
Hugely.
Or cosmically?
Hugely. Not cosmically, hugely. I think we're going to get a lot of crazies. And I think we're also in a very crazy time. Like I'm just as worried about the craziness and extremism that may come out of, say, the Federal Reserve or Congress in the next couple of months as we try to get a handle on our problems. So this is all going to be mutually exacerbating dynamic in the next 5 months.
So I think you're all wrong. We're cosmically effed there. I mean, there's very little doubt about this. Trump, if he runs, will get like 70% of the Republican vote in the Republican primary battles. No one's going to run against him that could really beat him in the MAGA lane. And it's just his party. Unless something, you know, extraordinary happens in the next year and a half, unless Melania and Jared and Ivanka, you know, there are little rumors about this, you know, talk him out of it on family grounds, or he just feels as though he doesn't have the energy, or there's some health issue, he's going to run and he's just going to stomp like Godzilla. And, you know, he has some chance of winning in 2024, the general election. The administration would be, you know, it's hard to see, you know, we get the C team of Trump appointees, because we went through the A and B team the first time around. The reaction on the left will just be unbelievable. I mean, there might be thousands of people just occupying Lafayette Square for a year. I wouldn't be shocked if, you know, there are assassination attempts against Trump cabinet officials. I mean, it's going to be crazy. But if he wants the Republican nomination at this juncture and what we've seen so far, you got to believe it's his for the taking. With that, let's pause and hear from our second sponsor this episode, Babbel. For most of us, learning a second language in high school or college wasn't exactly a high point in our academic careers. I chose German because there was a family background. My grandmother and grandfather were both German teachers, so I thought it'd be fun to try German. I thought, you know, French was too weak and soft a language, and Spanish was common, so I picked German. I now know basically no German, despite the fact that I took years of high school and college German. But now, thanks to Babbel, the language learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions, there's an addictively fun and easy way to learn a new language, whether you'll be traveling abroad, connecting in a deeper way with family, or you just have some free time. Babbel teaches bite-sized language lessons that you'll actually use in the real world. Babbel's 15-minute lessons make it the perfect way to learn a new language on the go. Other language learning apps use AI for the lesson plans, but Babbel lessons were created by over 100 language experts. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and before mentioned, German. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. There's so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, save up to 60% off your subscription when you go to babbel.com/editors. That's babbel.com/editors for up to 60% off your subscription. Babbel, language for life. Please check it out. So, Charlie, there's been a big internal conservative debate about this aid package that just passed Congress this week, $40 billion to Ukraine on top of $13 billion back in March, for $53 billion just to get us through to the end of the fiscal year, when presumably there'll be another package. You are a fiscal hawk. You have dissented from NR's editorial a couple months ago about the need for more defense spending, just wanting to tap the brakes on the grounds that we don't have a lot of money to throw around, given the red ink we're dealing with at the moment. Where are you on this?
I'm just glad that once again, Congress has engaged in such a meaningful and rigorous debate. I think the founders would be proud of it. You know, day after day, it's what I've seen on TV, long, earnest explanations from each lawmaker about where they stand. I mean, I have a number of thoughts. One, why do we have a Congress? Where was the debate? This is a lot of money. Maybe it's a good idea. It's certainly within the purview of the federal government for once, so that's a plus. But you know, it's not even that this was rushed and therefore the arguments needed to be truncated. This is how Congress works now. I wish on matters of war, and yes, this is not a direct war. There's no declaration from the United States, but it relates to a war and it could lead to a war. Probably won't, but it could. I wish we had proper good faith dialogue in our national legislature, but we don't. insofar as this spending is defensible, and I think it is, I would like to see Congress acknowledge that this country is in a terrible fiscal situation and structure the spending accordingly. The progressive movement is mostly dishonest when it says, why is it that every time we want to spend money on childcare or healthcare or whatever, we're told no, but when we need money for war, it's right there. The vast majority of federal spending is not on war. It's not on the Defense Department. The majority of discretionary spending may be on war and the Defense Department. But once you factor in the federal budget, almost all of our spending is on care or Social Security. But I do think that the Republican Party and others who are worried about our annual deficits and our growing debt do have a responsibility to explain why spending $50 billion is not a problem in the same sense as spending $50 billion on pre-K is a problem. The money still has to come from somewhere. Now, I would like to have seen the money come from the massive pools, the slush funds that were created during COVID. The argument for creating those slush funds, one of them is currently hovering around the Department of Education. 93% of the emergency money that was sent to the states during COVID for pandemic relief has not been spent. About $120 billion, I think, is there. I would like to see some of that money and money from elsewhere be taken back. Like, we don't have that crisis anymore. We have a new one. The argument during COVID was the federal government has to respond. We told people to stay at home. The federal government can spend in a way the states can't, can borrow. We've got a crisis. We've got to send out the money. We'll deal with it later. All right, well, we did that. Almost all of it seems to have been stolen or pushed into the inflationary cycles. We did that, and now we don't have that problem anymore. So let's reclaim. I didn't see a single attempt to do it. I'm not saying it would have passed. I'm not saying it would have got enough votes in a Democratic-controlled Congress. But I didn't see any attempt. That's what bothers me. I can be convinced on the merits that this is a deal, that ultimately the United States is the world's greatest power, that it keeps the Pax Americana, and that in the long run, spending $40, $50 billion to bolster Ukraine against another actor is a steal compared to what we would have to pay if we didn't send it. I can be convinced of that. Some very smart people I know who know far more about this than I do believe that and have made that case to me, and I accept it. But where is the institutional movement to keep an eye on the books? Do we just throw money out there now and assume it's gone forever? It's crazy. There's a lot of floating crisis cash still in circulation. Let's take it, redirect it to this, and start to take seriously that we aren't balancing our budgets and that we are doing nothing to pay down this debt. There is no plan ever. The plan is forever to spend more than we take in until the sun hits the earth. And I cannot help but see this within the same light, even if I can be convinced on the merits that this policy is sound and that, unlike the vast majority of the other things that it does, this is actually a core role of the federal government.
So MBD, there's the fiscal case against it. I think you probably have more of a foreign policy case against it. Just let me respond to a few of Charlie's points. I think obviously it was absurdly rushed in the House. The Senate, they did have a week's worth of debate, which is a lot in the Senate terms. Obviously, we have a huge fiscal problem. It's just, the deficit, we're not balancing the budget on the basis of whether spending this money or not. You know, with the Democrats in charge, you're either voting against it because it's not going to be paid for. They're not going to claw back COVID money, although they should. Or you just have to accept that it's not going to be paid for. I think, you can argue the package could have been smaller in certain respects. The general support to the Ukrainian government, maybe the Europeans can do more of that. The food assistance, maybe we should be hammering, Gulf Arab states to pony up for that. They don't want to get involved in the actual dispute between Ukraine and Russia. But the rest of us, is replenishing our stocks of javelins, because we gave javelins to the Ukrainians on an emergency basis. It's paying for our deployments to NATO countries, which we have to pay for. And it's giving Ukraine more weapons and financing European purchases of weapons from us, of weapons that really no one else has. And this is just the appropriate leadership role in, I think, the most important alliance in the world, NATO. So I support it. I think, real world, this is the best you're going to get. And it's really important to stave off Russia, possibly defeat Russia, and to have it, happening without a U.S. troop and fighter in harm's way, or a NATO troop in harm's way, a soldier in harm's way, is just, as Charlie says, some people think it's a deal. In that respect, to me, it seems an obvious deal and on par with some of the successful Cold War initiatives. If you have guys in Afghanistan who are willing to fight and die for their countries, and all you have to give them is surface-to-air missiles to help them beat back an aggressive empire that hates us and wants to overturn the U.S.-led world order, that seems a deal to me.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things to respond to there. I mean, one thing on the fiscal side of it, I'm a little less worried about that, because if we know anything about giving money to Ukraine, it's that the stuff of it that gets into Ukraine, which won't be all of the $40 billion, usually that comes back out in the form of corrupt, politically connected oligarchs coming back and bringing it back to America to stuff it in phony charities and fake business schemes in the Midwest, the way Kolomoisky did for a decade. So, financially, maybe that's a wash, or maybe that helps the American Midwest. My problem is, as you said, politically. I mean, all of the political case for going to the hilt in supporting Ukraine in this war and doing nothing to seek an end to the war or a settlement soon, all the premises, I think you can look at it the opposite way. So people say, if we don't do this, Russia is, China will look at us and say, we're weak and we won't defend our commitments. And they'll go after Taiwan and upset the Pacific order. I think it could be exactly the opposite. It could be that China will say, NATO can't even commit itself just to defending NATO countries. They get involved in any skirmish, anywhere nearby, even to countries that aren't member states. And the United States is perfectly distracted again. And so now we have an opening. My other worry, of course, is that we don't have a defined end state, for this war or this money that we're heavily involved in, and that we may be, in fact, extending the war by helping Ukraine exceed its capacity for its native capacity for fighting. And of course, the worst outcome would be if we, in a sense, become pot committed to an outcome. So like in poker, sometimes you become pot committed. As the play goes on, you end up putting so much money into the center of the table that now you can no longer afford not to see the hand all the way through and put all your chips in. And the fact is, Russia's been exposed very badly in this war, and it looks like they will, if anything, no matter what outcome they achieve in Ukraine, I think the way this war has gone for them would warn them against messing with any other European neighbors. As we found out in Iraq, you can win a war, but still come away from it humbled and not anxious to get involved in further conflicts in that region. And on the other side, you know, Russia has made some significant gains in the past 2 days, it looks like. And so the more involved we are, the more we become afraid that in some way Putin is beating us, right? That he's not just beating Ukraine, he's beating the whole Western world order that came in to support Ukraine as well. So our honor is at risk as well. I think the U.S. has a strong interest both in seeing Russia punished, but we have another interest in seeing the war end quickly, because this war is dangerous towards food security, supply chain issues, fertilizer that's needed all around the world to keep bread being made across the planet, to prevent political turmoil in the third world. You know, Russia's proved surprisingly durable to the sanctions that we've imposed on them. And it's kind of warned me, as a friend put it, that GDP is not the measure of an economy, especially not when you specialize, as Russia does, in so many things you don't want to be without, which is grain, fertilizer, guns, oil. You know, Russia's still functioning. So anyway, that's all. I'm skeptical. I don't think that we have to cut Ukraine off necessarily, but if we're giving money, we have a say in what outcomes we want to see. We don't write blank checks in foreign policy, and I don't see Congress really debating what our end state, what we should seek. And I don't think we even know. I think we're just hoping that it's going to turn out well for us and badly for Putin. But it's a lot of involvement with not a lot of clarity on where we want it to head.
So, Maddie Kearns, you could be not the tiebreaker, but the tie maker here by siding with me in supporting this $40 billion package, or short-sightedly and foolishly adding Charlie and MBD.
Yeah, I think I'm inclined to agree more with you, Rich.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Wow, Scott, who wants to spend money.
Well, there you go. Well, it's not my money, so no, I'm just kidding. But the fact is, whether it was right or wrong, the US has decided that it's in their national interest to be involved in this conflict, and they have committed to a course of action. And I think this is the only option at this point, is to continue this kind of support. I thought it was well defended. I thought Ted Cruz gave a good speech, talking about the various specifics of where this money would go and the principle defending it. I think, as we mentioned in our editorial, a significant portion would actually go to just replenishing US stock of weapons that we've already given. So again, we're already committed to this course of action, so we need to replenish US stock. And then, you know, I think a lot of that military hardware, to Michael's point about potentially wasting money, is going to move quite immediately to the battlefield. So I'm less concerned about that. But I think the alternative at this point, which is to just stop support, would be really dishonorable, given that we've already started down this course. And so we need to see it through. And there's also the argument about how that plays in geopolitical terms to sending signals to China regarding Taiwan and the rest of it. So we're on this track, whether Michael likes it or not, I'm afraid.
So Charlie Cook, X question to you. To this point, basically the Republican criticism of Biden has been that he's been too weak, too soft, too slow in supporting Ukraine. That will still be the main Republican criticism of Biden going forward, or will it steadily become Biden is too involved in spending too much to support Ukraine?
Well, I think if the Republican Party's current messaging is anything to go by, it might be both at the same time, even though they're mutually exclusive. I think over time they'll probably resolve in favor of he's too involved and sending too much of your money over there.
MBD.
Yeah, I don't know. I almost sense that there's a like a conservative kick reflex coming in, and conservatives are sensing somehow that the Biden administration is partly committed to this war because they see Russia almost as like a foreign proxy for domestic culture war. And they're therefore starting to lose interest. I mean, there's just some evidence in polls that Republicans are less enthusiastic about this conflict, even if they'll still call Biden not tough enough in a poll. So I don't know, what was the measure I have to pick? What was the option?
So we'll shift over to more to he's too involved and spending too much.
I think it'll change on the dynamics of what's happening in the field. If Russia gobbles up any territory, I think Republicans, just by partisan instinct, will settle on, oh, Biden was a loser. Like, Biden invested in this and lost. So I think, yeah, if it looks like Putin is going to make any territorial gain in Ukraine because of this war, that'll be the line, is that Biden somehow lost in a fight he chose. Not that he's too involved, just that he's a loser.
Maddie Kearns.
Yeah, I think people understand that it's not a binary choice about whether to spend money in Ukraine and whether to waste money at home. So I think they're probably more likely to go for the he's just weak. This is just Afghanistan part two type rhetoric.
Yeah, I think it'll still, the balance will still be on weak, but I like Charlie's answer. It'll basically be both. It's like, he's too weak, he's too soft, and damn it, we're not going to spend for any of this aid and assistance that would be logically follow on from being stronger. So it'll be a little bit of both, but still the reflex will be hitting him for being too weak. With that, let me do quick and our plus plug, digital subscription service at nationalreview.com, your way around our metered paywall, your way to see many, many fewer ads, your way to comment on articles and blog posts and dig deeper into the NR community. If you haven't signed up for NR Plus already, join tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers and do it today. You log in, you sign in, it's a transformative experience. We have great deals running at any given moment. Plus, it's your way to support our very important journalism. So I urge everyone to please check it out. And if you're already signed up, thanks so much. Maddie Kearns, epic event this week. The disinformation board is being disbanded. We asked an exit question when we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago about whether it would survive or whether it would, you know, wither in the vine. I'm pretty sure I said no, it wouldn't survive in anything like its current form. I think that's what you said as well. I'm not sure. But anyway, it's gone. And there was this remarkable Washington Post story breaking the story of its demise, premised on the idea that was disinformation that undid the disinformation board. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I find that angle so amusing, the idea that this board was set up to be the last resistance against disinformation. It was going to provide this great, rigorous service, and yet it was defeated very quickly before it even really got off the ground by disinformation. So even if what they said was true, it's at least, at the very least, incompetent. But yeah, clearly this was something that was ill-conceived from the outset. It was deeply unserious and I think embarrassing. You had the Mary Poppins of disinformation with her very embarrassing music video. And
so how embarrassing was that, Maddie? So you do singing yourself. How was she at musical theater?
Well, The singing was fine, but it was the context that was just really, it was really, really cringy, you know. I mean, I don't know how anybody who wants to work, who wants to work in politics should just not do things like that for very obvious reasons. But then also, you know, she was also like massively partisan, which was just destroys any credibility that this thing could have in the first place. So I don't think it's that surprising. I can't remember what I said, Rich. I can't remember if I said I thought it was going to wither, but I'll just pretend that I did say that.
So you were a witherer.
Yeah, probably. So I'm not surprised this happened, and good riddance to bad rubbish, frankly.
Yeah, so Charlie, the idea that that a disinformation board is not going to be sound ominous to people, and the idea that the whole thing wasn't ridiculous to begin with, that you would put this woman who was wrong on really key questions having to do with disinformation, Hunter Biden laptop, as the prime example, that and that everyone just should have accepted this in their commitment to good information is totally ridiculous.
Here's the bit that I don't get. Leave aside for a minute the details. Why did the Biden administration commit this wholly unforced error? Why? Its approval rating is in the toilet. And people already think that Democrats are authoritarian scolds. They already think that they wish to superintend the speech of American citizens. They already think that there is a disconnect between the average person speaking at a bar and the political class. They already think that the press and the Democratic Party have recalibrated their definitions of information and truth to line up perfectly with their own partisan and ideological imperatives. They already think that in some cases, the Democratic Party sounds a little bit Orwellian. And the Biden administration, in its infinite wisdom, decides that it will construct within the Department of Homeland Security, our most Russian-sounding agency, a misinformation board. Why? And then, to make matters worse, to run it, they hire this absolute liability, this weirdo, this freak, this person that must appeal to one small sliver of 1% of the country. I cannot imagine the sort of person who looked at Nina Jankowicz and said, she needs a good job in government. She needs to be put in an ankle monitor. That's what she needs. She should be studied. Why did they do it? Yes, they backed down, not because misinformation prevailed, although if it did, it's a good example of why the board should have been abolished for failure. Why did they do it in the first place? Are they so out of touch, so unable to anticipate the likely response that they couldn't see that coming? I'm still astonished by it. You don't lean into your weaknesses even when you're riding high. You certainly don't lean into your weaknesses when you're in Joe Biden's position, when you're in Nancy Pelosi's position, when you're in Chuck Schumer's position, when you're in the institutional Democratic Party's position, when you're in the position of those government officials who are blamed for the state of affairs on the border, which is what this related to ultimately. What a tone deaf mess. As for its apparently imminent demise, good. Taylor Lorenz, who wrote this absurd, probably in cahoots with Jankowicz, fluff piece about it, can say what she likes. But this was a wholly American reaction. This was the sort of reaction that is appropriate and necessary from a free people. And that reaction was, go shove it, no. No, no, no. Mockery, resistance. Yeah, of course people went and mined her social media posts. This is somebody who is supposedly in charge of ferreting out what the Democratic Party calls misinformation. We have every right to know what she thinks. But, you know, you don't find weird little Mary Poppins parodies if you go and mine, say, Rich Lowry's social media posts.
How do you know? Because you mine them?
Oh, yeah, right from the beginning, Rich. Every day. I'm never off that. But you don't find that on Maddie's. You don't find that on Michael. This isn't something that inexorably happens if you mine.
We got to do a fundraiser posts. Based on, you know, if we raise some gold, NBD will post a Mary Poppins.
Well, Dan Foster called her Mary Adjie Proppins, which I thought was genius. But I think that's an important point. All of the coverage in the Post and some of it in the Times and the Associated Press, it's made it sound as if you dive deep down into anyone in the government's social media posts, you'll find erotic songs about Harry Potter. No, you won't. I don't think that's a risk for Bill Barr. So Nina Jankowicz was mocked because she did all of those things. And I think it is encouraging, frankly, that this was the response of people in this country, and not just people on the right either.
So MBD, Charlie mentioned the ankle monitor, which made me think I've been reading this history of early Britain, and King John, I think it was besieging some town and agreed, told some leader if he surrendered, he wouldn't be put in irons. And then when he actually surrendered, he had fashioned silver manacles. So he could be follow through on his promise. That's good, honest government right there. So Nina Jankowicz, MBD, she's just, there's this little mini ecosystem that's been created around disinformation. So she became a disinformation expert and was like, yes, one of the leading authorities of disinformation. So of course, if you're going to have a disinformation board worth its salt, this disinformation authority should have been put in charge of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this all grew out of two things. One, of course, the disinformation panic, right, that has existed now since 2015, where the existence of internet-connected computers in Russia is held to automatically result in a kind of mind control of the vicious American masses who are just waiting to be activated by their Russian handlers through Facebook memes. That panic that has been ongoing and that is a multi-gazillion dollar effort, right? Publicity effort to try to pressure the social media companies to, I don't know, mind read what the government wants. But then during the pandemic, what the government found out was that the CDC's information could just be used by the social media companies as an automated right of reply to a citizen who disagreed with the government on a fact or on a strategy or policy. And so, you know, I think they want this for foreign policy measures. They want this for other measures. And I don't think it's going to end with this humiliation for the disinformation board. You know, I think there are going to be attempts to revive this. I think it's seen as, I think the temptation that liberal elites have fallen under since 2015, right? Like, you have to think about the kind of arc of their story. Like, in 2008, 9, 10, and 11, maybe even 12, liberal elites believed that digital technology and social media was effectively on their side, was going to deliver them more power and empower them to do more good. And then, you know, like some kind of ancient fable, the genie that they were relying on turned against them in 2015 and 2016. And it wasn't really the genie. It was just, you know, Facebook's users are older now, and they could observe that the American people were deliberating towards Donald Trump in that election on Facebook. And now they have this mythology that you can just control political outcomes by interrupting and superintending the political debate directly. This is not the job of the government, right? I mean, the government is supposed to grow out of our democratic deliberation. It's not supposed to control our democratic deliberation. So I just don't think this fight is over. I mean, this little battle has been won, but this is going to be ongoing. I mean, if Democrats were looking at the possibility of a big congressional majority, I think they would try laws like, you know, maybe Germany's social media bill or something like that, which when you read it, it would give you pause before posting on social media your support for the opposition parties. But they don't have that coming up, so they just tried to do it through the executive, and it's failed, but it'll be back again.
So Maddie Kearns, segue to the exit question. 2 or 3 years from now, the center-left will be equally obsessed with disinformation, quote unquote, as it is now. Yes or no?
Yes, it will be equally obsessed, if not more, depending on how 2024 turns out.
Joy Cook.
Yeah, I think this obsession has a little more to run. Equally.
And MBD, you're a yes.
Yeah, I think this is going to continue to grow.
I'll make it unanimous with that. Let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, you have discovered the most trenchant writer of our age.
Yeah, so years ago when I came to DC as a young man, you know, there's like a generation of writers and peers, and I always kind of kept track of them. And there was one guy who, you know, was kind of hanging around, and I thought he didn't write the clearest prose at all. He was kind of mysterious, kind of flaky, it seemed like. And now I think exactly on this topic of digital technology, he is an essential writer, and maybe one that's going to be remembered for decades after we're all gone. And it's my friend, I dare to call him that, James Poulos, who's been writing about the need for what he calls a Second Amendment to compute. And I think he is, I think he's nailed it in some of his recent writing and in a recent testimony before Congress about the way that our regime is tempted to use digital technology to do what communism couldn't do, which was to solve for politics, right? To end politics by instituting a full social credit system that works by treating the digital life as a proxy for governance in the real world. And I think he's onto the biggest idea going. And I don't know, I'm just like, it dawned on me this epiphany that he's a genius that I misunderstood, and now I'm going to try to help translate his ideas so that everyone can access them.
Maddie Kearns, you're back from a silent retreat.
I am, yeah. So a few years ago, I was reading Scalia's Meditations on Faith, on his Catholic faith, and I was struck by a line he said, if you're a Catholic and you don't go on retreat at least once a year, then there's something seriously disordered in your priorities. And since reading that, I've tried to make it a yearly thing. So went with a girlfriend and wasn't so silent because of that, but still got a lot out of it. I think it's, you know, it's easy for us moderns, especially because we're able to compartmentalize mortality and not really think about it, to bumble along thinking we're basically on track. But of course, the Gospels are full of warnings about that kind of complacency. So it's a great opportunity for reflection and resolutions. So I really enjoyed it.
Also, congratulations for playing to type. It's we're getting our spiritual advice from Antonin Scalia here at the, on the other podcast. Charlie Cook, you've been making pulled pork nachos.
Well, I didn't say I made them, but I certainly ate them, and they were made within my vicinity, and I had some role in their purchase. As did Moink, which is where the meat came from. Oh, they were just so good. But the best thing is the pork butt was cooked all day. and just sitting, working with that smell filling the house was glorious. And then at the end of the day, we pulled the pork apart and put it on tortilla chips and added some sour cream and guacamole and jalapeno peppers, and it was absolutely magnificent.
Can't go wrong. Can't go wrong. So I've been dealing with the blowback of having a very unpopular online opinion, which was when it was clear Madison Cawthorn had lost his bid for the Republican nomination. I said, this is great. I'm glad the voters of the 11th District of North Carolina made this choice. Chuck Edwards is great. Oh, and by the way, you know, I hope Madison Cawthorn has more to contribute, you know, it's just like a statement of human sympathy. And I don't want to suggest this bothered me. I find it more funny, but the blowback on Twitter, and then some guy, usually it's only when you've been on TV and it's something someone disagrees with that you get this level of commitment to clapping back. But a guy called and left a voicemail for like 2 minutes. Like, I'm a horrible person. I'm a horror show of a human being because I expressed this level of sympathy for Madison Cawthorn. I mean, you would have thought I posted some cringeworthy Mary Poppins parody, but no, I just wished Madison Cawthorn well, which I legitimately do. He was not a credit, as I said earlier, to the institution. This was not the right role for him, but he has dealt with a horrific, tragic accident, and I do wish him well and hope he finds another way to contribute. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is Charlie's Democrats Can't Fix What's Wrong with Joe Biden. Actually, there were a bunch of Charlie pieces I liked this week. It's one of those weeks where, you know, Charlie's on a big roll. But this one in particular just kind of gets to the heart of the way Democrats are misleading themselves about why Joe Biden is unpopular. And it's great.
Mick Ernst, what's your pick?
My pick is Nate Hochman's The Miraculous Rediscovery of Women, in which he points out the way that a lot of people on the left stop pretending that women don't exist when it comes to the hot button topic of abortion.
Charlie Cook.
My piece is by Kyle Smith. It's called So Long, Disinfo Nanny. It's about Nina Jankowicz. It has one of the great National Review subheads. A spoonful of public scrutiny helped Nina Jankowicz go down, which is, of course, a parody of Mary Poppins. And because Kyle is such a theater guy, he knows all of these theatrical and musical songs, and he imagines them being repurposed by Nina Jankowicz. It's a rip-roaring post.
My pick is a Capital Matters piece by our friend Brian Riedel, the Democrats' cynical greedflation narrative. And it's about how, not that it made any sense from the beginning, but this idea that inflation is being driven by corporate profiteering has been totally discredited by these quarterly reports from big corporations showing that they're actually losing out because inflation is eroding their revenues because they have to spend more on the types of things that everyone is spending more on, including fuel and all sorts of other goods that are spiraling, the prices of which are spiraling out of control. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast, and your rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes it sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Allegiance Gold and to Babbel. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. See you next time.